What is happening is that we're rapidly developing technology, new techniques for intervening in nature, new options for reproducing, options that we'll talk about today in terms of being able to design to some extent the genetic characteristics that organisms have. And with those tools, we then are in a situation of trying to decide what kind of characteristics would we like organisms to have if we have the power to make some modifications. One of the problems is that the technology for doing these things is developing very rapidly, and very often we suddenly find ourselves with all of these tools and abilities to do things, and yet we aren't sure what to do with them. In what situations is it appropriate to use them? Should we do everything that we have the technology for doing? Probably not. Well, we need to decide what we should do, not only what we can do. Situations is something like an airline pilot who says, "Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, this is your pilot speaking. We're flying at an altitude of 30,000 feet, speed of 600 miles an hour. I have two pieces of news to report, one good and one bad. The bad news is that we're lost. The good news is that we're making very good time. We have all these tools with us. What are we going to do with them?" What I'd like to start out with is to tell you a little bit through some slides about certain types of genetic interventions that we can make that aren't cloning, and then I'm going to go from there to cloning. I don't know if any of you were at the forum Monday night. We talked about genetic engineering then. Is there anyone here who was at the forum? Okay. What I'd like to do is tell you a little bit about options we have for supplying new genes to existing organisms, and then go from there to cloning, which is basically a technique for taking a particular genetic combination that's already in an organism and making a copy of it, sort of like making an identical twin genetically of somebody who already exists, except you wouldn't be the same age. That would be the difference. But genetically, it would be similar. So let's start out with some slides.
Lori, could you catch the light back there? The genetic modifications that are done right now are done mostly in bacteria. And this is a bacterium called E. coli, in which most of the work is done. If we take the bacterium and treat it in a certain way, usually with a detergent, we can get a picture that looks like this. Now all that thread-like stuff spreading out from the bacterium, can anyone guess what that stuff is? Right, that's DNA. That's the hereditary material. Basically the program for the genetic characteristics that we're going to have. Now, in bacteria, there are a couple of different kinds of DNA. And what's of interest, you see this little piece down here, it's looped back on itself in here, but it really amounts to a little ringlet of DNA. That's a special structure of DNA. It's called a plasmid. And that's what is used as the vehicle for carrying genetic information into a cell. And the way that it's done, and this is a Newsweek diagram, if we have a bacterium there on the left, we take out of it that little ringlet of DNA. It's called a plasmid. It's pretty easy to get hold of, because it's lighter than the other kind of DNA. And you disrupt the bacteria, get it out, and then the red sphere there in the middle is that plasmid. And then you treat it with some something called a restriction enzyme, and it opens it up in a very particular place. So you see the plasmid opened up. And then we get the other genetic material that we want to insert or splice in. And that's the purple stuff down here. We treat it in the same way, and we fragment it, and you see the end has a particular structure. And if we put that piece of DNA in with the plasmid, the ends kind of stick together, and there's another way of sort of gluing and sealing this spliced piece in. And then we have a unit, the plasmid, with a new chunk of genetic material spliced in. We can feed that back into the bacteria, and then the bacteria has new genetic information that it didn't have before. And that new genetic information, we could have isolated it naturally from some source, plant, animal, bacteria. It's also possible to chemically synthesize that piece. Because we understand something that's called a genetic code, it turns out that if you know the structure of the substance that the gene codes for, say a hormone of some kind, you can go backwards and figure out what would be the structure of the DNA that would code for it. And so you can then chemically synthesize a chunk of DNA that carries the instructions to make the product that you wanted to make. And there are ways then to turn the bacteria into miniature factories for it. This is a plasmid, a piece of DNA that has been cut by this enzyme, and this is just what it looks like with an electron microscope picture, and it's really not a whole lot different from what was shown in the diagram. And here's that plasmid about to enter back into the E. coli. The bacterium looks a little different here. It was treated in a certain way for the sake of the picture. But it's remarkably simple to do this procedure, to get the plasmid that's now got its new spliced piece of DNA that it's going to carry back into the bacteria. About all it takes is warming up the bacteria, putting in a salt solution, and that makes the membrane of the bacteria pliable, leaky enough that this can go back in without causing much damage. And although the know-how is important in this technique, the equipment is quite simple. And you can obtain plasmids, you can obtain enzymes that will cut it open and so on from commercial sources. And this type of work, it's called recombinant DNA, has been done as high school laboratory experiments in biology. So we're not talking about something that only a highly sophisticated laboratory would be capable of doing. You need the know-how, but you don't. The equipment itself is fairly simple. Now this is a picture of a modified strain of bacteria that General Electric developed and asked the Supreme Court for permission to get a patent on this. They had possible use for oil spills, and General Electric gave them permission. The Supreme Court ruled that this was a product that they could receive a patent on, and now there is an immense race for profits going on in industry. There are a number of companies, even E.F. Hutton is speaking and everyone is listening, in terms of new companies that are making bacteria into little factories for certain products. Human insulin is one of the products that they're working on. On the cover of Time magazine about, I don't know, maybe 3 months ago, there was a picture of a fellow named Herb Boyer, and he's down in California. He's become a millionaire almost overnight by being one of the founders of one of the companies that's involved in doing this. And Stanford University, which some of the people there developed some of these techniques, they've just received permission there. They're telling people if they want to use this technique, they have to pay Stanford a certain amount. They have patent rights for the procedure itself. A number of universities are now forming liaisons. with industry. A German drug company has promised MIT, I can't remember now if it's 30 million or 50 million over the next few years, to collaborate on this type of work. Okay, well, that's really not exactly the main topic for today. That technique that we described is a way of taking an existing organism and supplying to it new genes, new genetic information that it didn't possess before. That's different from cloning. And cloning is a word that has several different meanings, depending on the context in which it's used. But commonly, it means growing up a whole organism from an original single cell. You can take from one cell, you can go up to a whole organism and duplicate an organism from a cell from some other organism. It's easier to do with plants than with animals. And about two decades ago, some work was done at Cornell using tips from carrots. And if you isolate the cells there and put them in with the right nutrients, each of those individual cells can become a starting point for the development of an individual carrot. Now, it's a little bit more complicated doing it with animals, but probably most of the work has been done with frogs. The way it works with frogs is this. Now, let's see. Let's put it this way. Almost all the cells in our body, except a few, have the same set of genetic instructions as the fertilized egg from which we develop, barring mutations or damage. In the meantime, it's basically the same set of information. If we were to try to make a copy of a frog from an existing frog, many cells in the body would have the right package of genetic instructions that corresponded to the fertilized egg from which that frog originally developed. There is a problem, though. As we get older, our cells tend to specialize in terms of what bits of available genetic information are used in a cell. For example, think of the different kinds of cells we have in our bodies. Liver cells, kidney cells, brain cells, what have you. They all have basically the same library of genetic information, but different cells pick different portions of the available genetic information to actually put into action in the cell, and that's why certain cells have different characteristics from other cells. And this process of specialization becomes a problem, because think of that freshly fertilized egg. There you have a set of genetic instructions that has to be able to go in many directions to make up the variety of different cells that make up a whole organism. Some cells, after they specialize, become heart cells. For example, we don't know how to turn back the clock and unspecialize them, so we could start with that cell, and it would make kidney cells, skin cells, and so on. So there is a problem in terms of what cells will work for this. But at any rate, with the frog, the basic idea is a nucleus transplant. Let's say we have our frog over here we want to make a genetic copy of. We get a frog egg, unfertilized, and we trade the nucleus in that unfertilized frog egg. Now, since it's unfertilized, that nucleus has only half as much genetic information as a fertilized egg would have. We remove its nucleus, or it could be destroyed by irradiation. But it's possible under the microscope, with just a tiny little probe, to go in and physically remove the nucleus without doing too much damage, at least some of the time, to the membrane. So now we have an unfertilized egg that doesn't have any nucleus at all. Then we go over to this frog that we are going to try to clone, make a genetic copy of, And if we can find a suitable cell, and intestinal cells have been used, skin cells have been used with quite modest success. We take one of those cells, let's say an intestinal cell from this frog, and we pluck out the nucleus from it. Again, this can be done under the microscope. We take that nucleus and put it into the unfertilized egg that now no longer has a functioning nucleus. Okay? So now we have sort of a fertilized egg. That is, the nucleus it had originally only had half the genetic information. But we put into it a nucleus from, say, a skin cell, an intestinal cell that has the whole complete set of genetic information. And then if everything goes right, if we can get the egg to start following the genetic information of the new nucleus that we put in, and if we can get it to develop all the different kinds of cells that have to make up a whole frog instead of just making more intestinal cells, if we can get it to go in all these directions, we end up with a frog that is genetically the same as the frog that supplied that intestinal cell in the first place. A very important thing to keep in mind in the work that has been done is that this experiment, under optimal conditions, fails over 90% of the time. And they have yet to do it successfully, taking a cell from an adult frog to supply the nucleus and then growing up a copy. They use tadpoles, earlier stage of development, to supply the nuclei. And this is probably related to the fact that as an organism gets older, this specialization process goes on further, and at least we don't yet know how to turn back the clock and completely unspecialize. At least in 1977, I know that they have not yet been able to take an adult frog and take a cell from it and grow up an adult frog. They had gotten adult frog cells and gotten them up as far as the tadpole stage, and then something would go wrong. Or they could start with a tadpole cell and get up to the adult. But this is something important to keep in mind, because when we talk about what are the situations where you might use cloning, at least for now, we don't know how to start with an adult and make a copy of an adult. So when we think about, well, it would be nice to take some person who has genetic qualities that somebody might think are desirable to have another copy of, we can't do it with the adult. We'd have to find out pretty early that they had the characteristics we were after. So as you understand, of course, we've only had success with frogs. That's not quite true. If you bend the meaning a little bit of what we mean by cloning, there have been some experiments done with animals. I don't have a slide of this one, but let me try to explain it and see if it makes sense to you. The technique is to take an egg and a sperm, let the fertilization take place, but before the genetic material from the egg and the sperm fuse together into one common unit, one common nucleus, you separate, physically remove one set of chromosomes. And you can do it either to the chromosomes that were in the egg or in the sperm. Okay, so at the moment, what you have is an egg with either the original set of genetic material, if you fertilized and then pulled back out the sperm genetic material, or you've got an unfertilized egg with just the sperm genetic material, if it's the egg set. that you removed. Okay, you still have the problem that you've only got half as much genetic material as would be present in a fertilized egg. But then by some chemical manipulations, it's possible to get that set of genetic information to double without the egg dividing. So what you're really getting is a double dose of the genetic material that was in the egg or that was in the sperm, whichever set you left in the egg. Okay? Now this has been done with mice. And then what you do with that, if it starts developing, you implant it in a female mouse and the pregnancy ensues and you produce an offspring that has genetic material only coming from one parent. Now, it isn't genetically identical to the parent because for a given female, each egg is a little bit different in terms of the combination of genes that's in it, and each sperm is a little different in terms of the combination of which genes are in a given sperm. If that weren't the case, a given male and female would keep churning out identical genetic children. But we have this random sorting of genes when eggs and sperm are produced. But you can say that that offspring has genes from only one parent. And they've done it both ways. From the male set... Yes, they've done it both ways. From the male set, from the female set. It turns out that when you do this, there's only one sex you can produce, though. Is there anyone here with enough genetics background to figure out why you could produce one sex but not the other? What? Yeah, you can only produce females, and why is that? Yeah. Remember, you're getting a double dose of the chromosomes. Well, females have two X chromosomes. A male has an X and a Y. Now, if we produce an individual that has a YY and no X, those individuals don't have a sufficient genetic information to develop into a baby, and they would just die at that stage. Now, see, the sperm can carry an X chromosome. So you could use the sperm's genetic information, if it's that kind of a sperm, and produce a female out of it. It seems odd that you could use the sperm's material and produce a female that doesn't have any genetic characteristics that the donor doesn't have, or at least any genes, because the donor is of a different sex. Well, one other procedure that I might describe briefly. Now I'm trying to this one is similar. In fact, I forget the difference between this one and the procedure I just described. But what this will illustrate is that this is the egg cell there. That's the spherical material there in the middle. It's being held by suction in place by a device down there on the bottom. That's a little micropipette up there at the top. And it's possible to go in there and physically remove genetic material or add genetic material. Usually they have to treat the cell with a certain chemical that makes the membrane soft enough so that poking this thing in and out won't cause too much damage. It also seems that if you just poke genetic material in there or take it out, that isn't enough to get the egg to start developing into an embryo. And with these later techniques, that's why they let the fertilization take place, but then they fish out one set of genes before it becomes part of the actual offspring. Somehow, the natural fertilization helps trigger the embryonic development, which doesn't happen as reliably if you don't let that step take place. This is a fellow whose name is David Rorvik, and in 1978 he wrote a book called In His Image, The Cloning of a Man. It generated quite a bit of controversy because Rorvik claimed that he was writing nonfiction, and virtually all scientists believed that he was writing fiction. He claimed that there was a 67-year-old millionaire who had the pseudonym of Max, who was unmarried. He wanted to have an heir because Max himself had been adopted and wasn't too sure about his own genetic parentage. Somehow he had strong feelings that he'd like his offspring not to have that to wonder about, and he decided that he would like to be cloned. Now, the idea here would be analogous to a nucleus transplant. If it worked, Max would supply some cells, and a nucleus from that would go into an unfertilized egg, and then if we could get the egg to develop, it would become a genetic copy of Max. So according to the story, Max was very wealthy, and he bankrolled a large scientific operation. They set up a laboratory off in some South Sea island or someplace east of here. Everything was kept fuzzy because the author claimed that he had promised not to reveal specific details to about the parties involved. And lo and behold, after a year or two of experimentation, they figured out how to do it. According to the story, they enlisted some native women there. They just told the women they were engaged in some research and didn't tell them specifically what it was about. All of a sudden, one of these women found herself pregnant with a baby that was supposed to be a genetic copy of Max. Fortunately, Max and this woman developed an affection for each other, and it had a sort of happy ending to it, although it was left unresolved whether the romance flourished beyond that point. But at any rate, according to Rorvik then, this baby was born. One of the ways that you could test the idea of the boy being an actual clone. Now, in this method of cloning, when you use a nucleus transplant, the offspring is going to be the same sex as the donor of the nucleus, and you could do it either male or female by the straight nucleus transplant. But if the offspring is really a clone, that means they aren't going to have any genes that the parent didn't have, and there are transplant experiments that you could do between them. It would be something like identical twins being able to transplant tissues without the rejection problem. So allegedly these kinds of tests were done and they bore out the hypothesis. But there's been no hard evidence coming as a result of it, and nobody seriously believes that the story is true. By the way, Rorvik apparently is a good Norwegian, and this story has had wide sales over in Norway as well. So if any of you are Norwegian, as I am, I think we've all been had. The cloning is being used in certain applications, particularly with plants. There are patented methods for cloning orchids. There's work being done with palm trees, trying to find strains that are very rapidly growing, healthy under certain set of conditions. In some cases, it's cheaper and easier to use cloning than any other method, and then you get an exact genetic replica. Among speculations, cloning has been proposed as a nice idea if we have a couple where one of the
one of the people has a genetic disorder that where there's a risk to the offspring, by making a genetic copy of either the husband or the wife, you would circumvent the chances that their genes would combine to form a dangerous combination. You would form somebody who has the same genetic constitution as whoever was cloned. There are those who view cloning as a nice way of finally resolving for once and for all how much characteristics like intelligence are a function of genes versus environment. All of a sudden now you can produce a large population of genetically identical individuals. You can vary their environments and have a very nice control group to get more clean-cut data instead of all the arguing that's going on right now. Some people see cloning as a sort of form of immortality, a way of carrying on not just some of your genes into the next generation in combination with someone else's genes, but exactly your own genes. For space travel, it might be handy to, if you're going to be gone for many thousands of years, to keep serially cloning, and there would be somebody around there when it's time to arrive. Kings who worry about having heirs, they want male children. This could be handled by cloning. Clones could be a source of spare parts. Have yourself cloned, have someone stored away. You would have transplanting options with each other without rejection as a problem. I'm not advocating any of these. I'm just going through a list of some of the speculations here. Oh, another interesting point is that some of the people who've had themselves frozen away, this is a technique which is rapidly losing popularity, but starting about a decade ago, they didn't wake up. There have been people who've been taken out of cold storage because it was just, it costs, about $50,000, and then there is most of the people make provisions in their will so that there's income that pays for the year-to-year maintenance. I could just take a minute and describe the procedure. When people are frozen away, we'll get back to what this has to do with cloning in a minute. They're usually cooled down on a bed of ice with salt. One of the problems with freezing tissue is that water expands when it freezes, and our cells have large amounts of water. So usually the water is replaced by some other fluid that doesn't expand so much when it freezes. Ethylene glycol, which is antifreeze, is one. DMSO, which has gotten a lot of press lately, is another one. Anyway, they just go in through an artery and flush this fluid through, gradually cool you down onto dry ice, and then finally wrap you up in some aluminum foil and put you in a liquid nitrogen container, essentially a glorified thermos bottle, and then you're maintained in that condition. There are two reasons that some people believed were persuasive for having this done to them. One was perhaps a cure for whatever was ailing them would be discovered after a while and they could be thawed out and cured. The only problem is that you can only go through this after you've already died, and there were some people who wanted to be able to go through this before they actually died so that there would be a greater chance they could be thawed back out and still be alive and then cured. But in most states that's called murder, and so that didn't get very far. It's very difficult even to freeze tissues, individual tissues, unless it's very thin. There are all kinds of technical problems with the freezing. But the other option that some people had in mind is that at least you might be able to preserve some cells. And if you could get some cells, you could get some nuclei and you could do some cloning work. There have become horrible problems in terms of property rights and who, at what point can you inherit something if somebody is basically put on hold pending possible recall. An important thing to keep in mind is that we're only talking about genetic characteristics. Many of you have seen the movie or read the book. What was the one where Hitler, Boys from Brazil, right? And of course, our personality characteristics are not certainly not solely a function of our genes. People get in trouble for saying to any extent they're a function of our genes. But in the Boys of Brazil, genetic copies of Hitler were made. I suspect that if this were really done, there would be some of those individuals who, given the right environment, would turn out to be very nice people, probably reasonably bright. One of the objections to cloning is that why would we choose, suppose we wanted to clone Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, would we expect his copy to be a basketball player or Rubinstein to be a pianist? Would we impose expectations on the clone that compromises to some extent their freedom as an individual to pursue what they want to pursue? Now, to an extent, we all impose expectations on our children, and so it is a matter of degree. If we cloned Abraham Lincoln, and we can't now because we don't have any of those cells, but if you wanted to become and work at McDonald's, would we feel a twinge of disappointment at what he had chosen for his life's work? There's also an interesting thing. There's a difference between identical twins and clones in that you're separated in age, but yet identical twins, there is a certain psychological bond and tendencies that are familiar. What if you mix this with the, say, a parental relationship? A fellow by the name of Paul Ramsey, who I quoted once before, he's a professor of Christian ethics at Princeton, he said this: our children begin with a unique genetic independence of us, analogous to the personal independence that sooner or later we must grant them or have wrested from us. For us to choose to replicate ourselves in them, to make ourselves the foreknowers and creators of every one of their specific genetic predispositions, might well prove to be a psychologically and personally unendurable undertaking. Now, that may or may not be the case, but there certainly would be a new psychological situation here. Another point is that if cloning were ever used on a massive scale, we would run into a problem with what's called genetic diversity. If everybody, or if a sizable segment of the population had the same identical genetic makeup, we would have a similar susceptibility to certain infectious agents or other kinds of problems. This is a problem which is seen in agriculture when vast amounts of land are planted with the identical variety. If you get a pest that's particularly harmful to that strain, you wipe out an immense proportion of the population because it's all of that same particular type. Do you have any thoughts on cloning or reactions to anything that's been said? The guesstimate is that there are probably no more than 24 people frozen. One of the cryonics institutes recently went out of business. There was a surge of popularity in the early 70s, but it just hasn't been sustained, and the increase in customers hasn't been forthcoming, so it's not a very promising place to invest your money these days. Allegedly, Walt Disney is one of the people who's being frozen away awaiting a return. Walt Disney. We could probably use his return, judging from some of the Disney productions lately. I wouldn't think so. Well, this is intertwined with another interesting question relating to mental function. I mentioned the other day that I've also heard a contention by a physician that if you cloned someone, the clone wouldn't have a soul, that the soul was an entity that resided in the original, and if you had a chip off the old block, so to speak, you couldn't take the soul with you. Now, I guess I have a different concept of what the soul is than many people do. I mean, if you view it as a single entity that floats down and inhabits a specific body, then you might have a different view of whether a clone has a soul. I'd be interested in what anyone out there thinks in terms of memory. Certainly our memory is a function of our experience, and the clones haven't had that experience. There's a wiring pattern. The wiring is a product of our experiences and our... to transplant some actual brain cells. I mean, you wouldn't use it as a starting material because you have this cell specialization problem. It's a genetic duplicate. I mean, twins, yeah, just in terms of hereditary characteristics. Now, I happen to believe that genes have a bit more to do with our behavior than we would like to believe. It's been probably overstated. There's a school of thought called sociobiology, which tries to relate a vast amount of behavior to our genetic or other physical characteristics. That's probably a strong overstatement of the link, but at least as a parent of two children, I think there are some distinct behavioral tendencies that they have that are not solely a function of being in slightly different environments. There's a high degree of plasticity in behavior, a range of potentials to be sure, but I personally don't believe that we are blank slates without any genetic predispositions. I'm sorry, I didn't hear you. The question had to do with Dr. Shockley's ideas. Shockley, as a number of you know, is a Nobel laureate for inventing, or co-inventor of the transistor. He teaches at Stanford. He's one of the Nobel laureates whose sperm is available through the sperm bank of Robert Graham in California. So if you're impressed with him, you can carry that a step further. I'm not making a pitch for his sperm. He advocates the idea that there is, on the average, a difference, for example, in intelligence between races, with the striking allegation is that blacks are a little bit inferior on the average, although obviously there's enormous overlap between individuals. That, at the moment, is an unresolvable problem because of the arguments of cultural bias in the tests themselves. I hesitate to say what I'm going to say next. It occurred to me when I was, I think, out jogging one day, that if in fact there were a difference, and I have no idea if there is, and I'm in no way suggesting that there is, and I certainly prefer to believe that there isn't a difference. Okay, with that disclaimer, it occurred to me that there is a possible rationale I could come up with that makes a little bit of sense that would lead to a difference. And let me try it out on you. I mentioned it to an anthropology friend who wasn't at all impressed with it but didn't really give me a reason why. And it's probably because none of us want to believe that there is a difference, and there's no good evidence that there is. Okay, again, I want to repeat that disclaimer. What I wonder is, over a long period of evolution, there in general is the black population is more distributed near sunny climates. There's a reason for that. The pigmentation protects those people against overexposure to sunlight, which could give an excess of vitamin D and other things. People who live further away from the sun tend to have lighter skin because we need the UV light to make vitamin D and so on. Okay, so first of all, there is a connection between location on the globe and skin color. What I'm wondering is, would it also be true that in areas on the globe more distant from the equator, where there's less sunlight, that the conditions needed for survival are a bit more rigorous, and that there would be some premium put on ability to cope with a harsher environment? One advantage in such an environment, perhaps, could be intelligence. I happen to believe that there is some genetic contribution to intelligence. I wouldn't dream of saying how much is that, because obviously you can change IQ tests enormously with coaching and proper environment and so on. But I just wonder whether the same environment that favors light skin is also an environment where it's particularly advantageous to be bright, to cope with the more difficult surroundings. That's just a thought that popped into my mind, and I throw it up for whatever. Yeah. Yeah. There are also, the Eskimos have some pigmentation of the skin, and yet they're living a long ways away from the equator. Yeah, they came over, did they come over the bridge from over the Bering Strait when it was there? My knowledge of anthropology is so meager that I have not the foggiest idea whether that idea could be pushed, and I wouldn't care to push it because I don't care to believe there is a difference, and there isn't any good evidence that there is. But anyway, I would just hate for there to be one more reason to put down another group. It may be wishful. Yeah. Right. Good point. Good point. Some other idea. If we were to just clone the geniuses, it could be too that intelligence may be linked to certain other characteristics. I don't know whether being a musician, to the extent that there's a tendency genetically, they're often high-strung temperament and musicianship. I know quite a few examples, and my mother's a musician, so I can say it. There may be a linking, a combination of characteristics. We might go for one that we like, but we might bring along with it something else that wouldn't be so advantageous, right? Another interesting point on that is that you might genetically try to people who are hypersensitive to certain things, it may be a hair trigger immune response, and you might like to tone down the immune response for those people, but the immune response may turn out to be helpful in combating cancer, and so you may have to choose your poison between allergy problems and potential susceptibility to cancer. So, you know, it's not quite so easy to pick and choose. And furthermore, things like intelligence, to the extent that they do have a genetic component, these are a function of many genes, and it's just not the kind of thing you casually can. You can't do it by the first method I talked about, inserting genes. However, cloning, of course, you do get the whole package at once. But if you clone somebody, would you have to recreate the whole environment the original was brought up in if you're going to get them to have all those traits that you admire, that is the reason for you cloning them in the first place? It would get a bit expensive. I guess we didn't get into sex selection, but tomorrow we'll talk about amniocentesis and genetic diseases, and one of the options there is to make a pregnancy decision based on the sex of the fetus. With cloning, this is a way of selecting the sex. You could have an all-female society with cloning. You couldn't really have an all-male society because you need that unfertilized egg. So you ladies have it made as soon as this women's lib will be complete. Right, even unfertilized eggs may become optional. Yeah. Anything else anybody wants to ask about or comment on? Yeah. Let me just run through the range of places where sex selection would be possible. One is before conception. We talked about with artificial insemination, there are laboratory methods. At the moment, they just work well for getting sperm that have a higher than 50% chance of producing boys, about 70%. But you've got two kinds of sperm, the male producing and the female producing. And in theory, the lab techniques can be improved so you get a sample that is 95% likely to produce a particular sex. We aren't there yet, but that's one method. Because with artificial insemination, you have the sperm out in the laboratory and you can do what you want to it before the insemination occurs. There's also a recipe, as many of you know, for timing intercourse with ovulation to tilt the odds in favor of a boy or girl. This is based on the speed of motion of the sperm and also their susceptibility, their survival time prior to the time that the egg's available for fertilization. This is also coupled with douches, acid or alkaline, because there's a difference in the susceptibility of the two types of sperm. The people who advocate this method claim about an 80% success method of getting the desired sex. However, the recipe is such that if you're going for a boy, you want to time insemination with ovulation, and that's the time when you have the highest chance of pregnancy anyway. If you're going for a girl, insemination has to occur 2.5 or 3 days before ovulation if you want high odds. And your odds might be pretty good of getting a girl if you get a child, but your chances of pregnancy are diminished considerably if the sperm have to wait around that long before the egg is available. There are thoughts that eventually there will be agents using the immune system that can discriminate between the two kinds of sperm and basically knock one out and not the other, and that would be a more efficient way of proceeding with this. Cloning would be a way of pre-selecting the sex were it available. Personally, I hope we never clone a human being. And then the other level of sex selection, it isn't pre-selection, that is to begin the pregnancy and then find out the sex and then decide what to do. That obviously carries much heavier ethical objections because it means selective abortion based on sex. In some cultures, this is being done. There was a report in China. 100 women went in to have the sex of their babies identified early in pregnancy. Of those who found out they were carrying boys, 2% elected to abort. Of those who found they were carrying girls, 69% elected to abort. Now, the cultural preferences for sex vary, and it's different there than it would be here. But there are surveys that indicate a preference here in the U.S. also to have male children, particularly as the first child. You can also look at couples who've had children. More couples quit after they've had a boy than after they've had a girl, which some people read to mean they have now achieved whatever balance and composition they wish in their family. You don't have to interpret it that way, but you can. Time's about up anyway. Okay, thank you.